sitting in for Tom Flanagan. Today, we're joined in the studio by Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum for a conversation on our changing community. If you'd like to join that conversation, you can do so by calling 414-1234. Send us an email at perspectives@wfsu.org or find us on Twitter at WFSUPerspective. Mayor Gillum, thanks so much for joining
us
today.
Thank you very much, Regan, for having me here. It's a real pleasure.
Yeah, definitely. One thing I want to talk to you about maybe to get us started here is the Longest Table program in Tallahassee. We just wrapped up our third event.
That's right.
Is that right?
That's right.
Tell me about that.
Yeah. So we just wrapped up our third Longest Table installment. And some of your listeners may remember we kicked this off last year almost to the day where we shut down Park Avenue downtown and ran a 400-person dinner table. Supper table, as my grandmother would call it, down the street, and invited our friends, our neighbors, strangers to sit down, break bread together, get to know each other, and have some conversation. We ran a table runner down the center of the table and put thought bubbles in it, just provoking questions, right, to get folks started talking. And this past Sunday, we had our third event where we had over 1,000 folks around our community come together to participate. The second event, which is a little different from the first. And the third event took place in small tables, if you will, and businesses and restaurants and homes at faith community centers all around our community. We had 850 people, participate at that time. And so it's a growing event. It's an event that I think is, as I've described before, where Tallahassee can come to meet itself. Folks from different sides of town, different backgrounds, and we trust that when you bring people together that they'll have important and relevant conversations. And if nothing else, they'll get to meet someone new that they didn't know before. And hopefully it opens up their minds to, instead of being judgmental when they hear stories or experiences that are different than theirs, they'll choose to be more curious. That's what we're trying to stimulate, more community building and more connections.
Mm-hmm. What's the plan for that program moving forward?
Yeah, so it's our intention to continue to hold two events a year at a minimum. And I have to tell you, this past year, even though we hosted two events, officially Longest Table events, we got outreach all throughout the year between those events from folks saying, hey, is it okay if I reach back out to the folks that I hosted at my table and have a conversation about community policing? Or racial reconciliation. And a lot of that was spawned out of the very tragic events that took place in Minnesota, in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, in Dallas, Texas, where folks were really feeling an urge to come together and have meaningful conversation. The faith events that we hosted and the aftermath of those events to bring folks together was in large part inspired by folks from the Longest Table listserv getting together and saying, hey, is there something we can do to bring healing and connection and reconciliation in our own community?
Mm-hmm. What are we learning from that? I mean, are there some sort of big picture points that you've been able to take away from that?
Well, certainly what I've heard from folks is they find it really, really meaningful to be in community with their neighbors and people that they don't even know. For me, the real urgency around this kind of surfaced in the aftermath of what happened in Ferguson. And then even further, as we begin to debate our own local budget and where we were going to put our budget priorities, there was a survey conducted by the City Commission that showed that 90% of the people considered this community safe and they felt safe in their neighborhoods and their homes. Now, that's a good thing. But if you don't recognize that there are parts of our community that don't share in that same sense of comfort around safety and security for themselves and for their family members, you might not understand why we would need to put the kind of resources that we did into community policing, into body cameras, into hiring new law enforcement officers, but also into taking a more systemic approach at the issues that we believe contribute to our crime rate here locally, things like poverty, access access to opportunity and jobs, graduation rates, health rates in our community. All these factors that may seem disconnected, but are in fact very connected to the issues that we confront when we're dealing with the crime rate. And so our need to help explain to the community, and we have a smart city, let's not mistake anybody, but the truth is that sometimes we can rock ourselves and cradle ourselves into comfort in our little part of the community and our little special place. And sometimes that makes you a little hardened to what other parts of our community may be facing. And so in a roundabout way for me, the longest table was also an effort to sort of highlight that, you know what, everyone doesn't experience Tallahassee the same. We experience it through our own individual lenses. And for some people, those lenses are rosier than others.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I guess I'm wondering, how is that working? I know that a goal of the longest table, like you were saying, is to put community members together who might not otherwise get to sit down and have a conversation. But anecdotally, I attended a longest table event that we actually hosted here at WFSU.
Nice.
And there, you know, it was a lot of people like me, highly educated mm-hmm. people with, good jobs, you know, not people that I can relate to. I can already picture probably what is their life like.
Yeah.
Is that working out for you?
So one, we got to make sure we intervene on diversifying that table that you sit at the next time. Because at my table, we had folks from our Palmer Monroe Teen Center who come from what you might describe as a broken household, a single parent home. The young man growing up spent some of the time at his grandmother's house, some of the time with his mom, some of the time with his aunt, just because of the conditions that they grew up in. We had former firefighters, a former firefighter, I should say. We had folks who had experienced being laid off. We also had a college professor. We also had my wife and myself and our very diverse backgrounds and experiences. And what we've tried to do here is there's a little bit of engineering on our part that we do recruit targeted communities that we want to make sure are also included at this table. We're on our third event, and it's my hope that over time we'll continue to expand those boundaries and experiences. But I'll tell you, while we maybe you were at a table that it consisted of folks that were more educated and had more opportunity, maybe it is also true that everyone didn't start there. And so there's a range of experiences that they also bring to that experience, right? I mean, I didn't start as mayor. I started as one of seven kids to my parents who didn't go to college, and I'm the first of my family to have gone to college and graduated. My mother was a school bus driver, and my daddy was a construction worker. And the hopes and aspirations that they had for me was just that I would go to school, get my lesson, pay attention to my teachers, and one day, maybe one day, be able to get to college and bring home a better education as example for my siblings and for my family members and for my neighbors. And so I'll never forget that experience. And it is that experience that informs a lot of my approach to public policy making in this community.
Mm-hmm. Let's transition a little bit here. I wanted to talk to you about, I know that you're really spearheading an initiative to make Tallahassee family friendly. Mm-hmm. You're looking into schools, business, looking for ways to make Tallahassee a family friendly place. Tell me a little bit about what does that consist of?
Yeah. So we have launched a year ago when I came into office as mayor, our Family First initiative. And it really consists of four prongs. One, to help create more family-friendly workplaces. How do we create working environments that are supportive of parents in whatever form parenthood and guardianship takes? Two, how do we create the environment where every single parent has access, regardless of their income, their socioeconomic status, that their children have access to high-quality early childhood education centers. And we do that through what I hope we will eventually roll out throughout this entire community will be a quality rating system that will give guidance to families, to parents on from one center to the other, how do you rate and how do you assess – the quality of education that your child might receive. For so long, we've treated child care like daycare. It's an extension of babysitting, right? And the truth is that based off the science, we know that the most development over the life of the human, most brain development takes place between the ages of 0 and 3, a little over 80%. And between 0 and 5, over 90% of the brain is developed. Children are literally sponges during that period of time. They're soaking everything in language. And so we've set a goal of making sure of trying to guarantee that, one, our children get access to good quality early childhood education. Two, that they show up at kindergarten ready to learn. Roughly half our kids in this state aren't ready to learn when they hit kindergarten. And that thirdly, that by the time they get to the third grade, that every one of our community's children are reading on grade level. And the truth is that the inputs that help to create the conditions for that output begin much, much early on. We say 0 to 5 because even pre-maternal health has an impact on that. All through utero has an impact on that, the condition of the mother and the child. And then obviously, when they're born, the inputs that they are soaking in during that very critical period are extremely important. We also have a committee that is working on how it is that we fund, raise the resources. What are the resources that are going to be required to create those kinds of conditions for each one of our children to have access to high-quality early learning? And then fourth prerogative is a family support working group. That is, you know, I hate saying parent training, but the truth is that regardless of where you are in life, the most educated to the lesser educated folks, we all, when become parents, you know, start at zero. I mean, my wife and I were reading every book that we could get access to. We're constantly checking, are we doing this right? Are we doing this right? And it is so helpful for us to be in a community of other parents that are struggling with the same sort of questions, almost, you know, sort of self-teaching at the same time learning through peer mentorship. And so what does that apparatus look like for parents and families? We've got a working group committed to doing that. And I think if we can do those four things, Tallahassee will be a state leader in producing high-quality early childhood education opportunities.
All right, we're going to take a quick break here. I want to let everyone know that you can give us a call and join our conversation at 414-1234. Welcome back to Perspectives. I'm Regan McCarthy sitting in for Tom Flanagan. Today, we're talking to Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can do so by giving us a call at 414-1234. Send us an email at perspectives@wfsu.org or find us on Twitter at WFSUPerspective. Mayor Gillum, before the break, we were talking a little bit about your family-friendly initiatives, and that made me think about a question that I sometimes have or hear from people, which is Tallahassee sort of facing a little bit of an identity crisis? Mm. So you're talking about these efforts here to make a family-friendly community. You know, I guess the goal there would be to increase, you know, families' ability to live here in Tallahassee. We also are a college town. We've been reaching out to seniors. I know you had a proclamation claiming that there would be no snow in Tallahassee and seniors should come on and live here. They'll never have to shovel their sidewalks.
Right.
Millennials, young professionals. I mean, we're claiming Tallahassee as a place for everyone.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and it's true. And the truth is that I think the truth is that we are. We are an extremely extremely diverse community in the sense that not only do we have the normal forms of diversity, but we've also got age diversity. We've got income diversity. We've got educational diversity. We've got a diversity of types of work, and we're trying to grow the types of work. I mean, one of the things that we put a great emphasis on and my office has been around the ability to invest in the creative and innovative class by, you know, creating shared workspaces in an environment where our best and brightest thinkers and innovators don't have to be on the first thing flying out of here when they graduate. They can choose to stay in Tallahassee and to build a business in Tallahassee and to start their families here, right? And to recruit their parents to retire in a community like ours. We were named just a few months ago by StubHub as one of the best places to start a new business. We've also been named by AARP Magazine as one of the top places to retire in this community. And we're proud of those varied distinctions. Obviously, with a diversifying community, the needs and the demands from those communities are also diverse. And so we work very frequently and often to make sure that we're tending to the diverse needs of those constituencies. By one example, we are a growing community for assisted living and independent living, retirement centers and communities. Increasingly, we're seeing proposals come through for the development of new housing to meet the needs of that constituency. But we've also got a senior center, a city senior center that's bursting at the seams. They couldn't stand to add more programming if they wanted to because it's just that popular. So we've already scheduled as part of our Blueprint 2000 money resources to build a brand new senior service and active living facility in our community. But we've also then got the needs of the young talent that we're trying to recruit here who are challenged to find housing that they can afford in the parts of town that they want to live in. And so we've got an upcoming workshop at between the city and the county where both commissions will sit down and have a conversation around affordable housing options. Every time people probably hear affordable option, they probably think about the lower area median income, that 30 and 40% AMI. Well, we're talking about working people who earn pretty decent salaries, but maybe living by themselves, not yet married, want to live in downtown or around midtown, and are trying to find really, you know, reasonable places that they could purchase a home or even pay reasonable rents. And that's a challenge for them. I have young professionals in my office who find it as a challenge, and many of them are roomed. They're roommating with folks in order to afford our community. So, you know, there are real challenges that come with that, and we're trying to develop some strategies to help meet the growing demand of a very, very diverse and growing community.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that that's possible to meet the needs of all those different categories of people?
Yeah, I do think it's possible. Respectable, good growing cities do it every day. And I'm constantly reading journals and trying to find examples of communities that are similarly struggling and others that have made it through those challenges to make their community a model community, if you will, of bringing diverse constituents together and addressing diverse needs of those constituencies while trying to make sure that you tend to and don't lose focus on the basics of what it means to run and to grow a city. I think we've done some really smart things with regard to our development and planning processes. When I first got on the city commission, we had every year during the comprehensive plan process amendment after amendment asking for a waiver to grow and build outside of our city limits, stretching the boundaries of the urban services area. And the commission decided at that point we didn't want to do that, that we did not want to continue to incentivize sprawl in our city because it's an expensive process. The more and more you allow that growth, the more you have to extend those urban services area, and the more expensive it becomes in our city. And so we focused on infill development, redevelopment in the urban core. Now, with the addition of Wilani Plantation, where we've got over, you know, 500 acres out there that belong to the city and another 500 that are under contract by a private developer, we're now beginning to extend and open up new residential lot development to help us meet both our housing needs, our diversified housing needs, but also we're doing it in a very thoughtful and conscious way around how it is that we grow this community. City limits of the city of Tallahassee are roughly, 308 square miles. Leon County, almost 800 square miles beyond that. And so land is a very, very precious resource, and we've got to be smart about how it is that we use that and how we develop this community in a way that makes way for reasonable growth so that we don't have the kind of housing pressure that I think we see today, but also don't grow too quickly and too far outside of those urban areas that, quite frankly, you end up having to grow substantially the city budget because of the expense of extending those urban services further and further out.
Mm-hmm. I think urban development has been a big focus for you as you've been mayor. I have seen you really spearheading a lot of work, like especially along the Gaines Street area, going down to Cascades Park.
Absolutely.
Tell me a little bit about what is your goal there? You know, what is your vision for Tallahassee?
Well, I tell you, when I first started paying attention to politics here, and frankly, when I first got elected in 2003, we didn't really refer to there weren't really districts in this city, right? Most people said South Side or you lived in the North Side. I mean, those were the geographical districts, if you will. And today, I can't even keep up with the number of districts. I mean, just as we flow from this building where we are today, you approach the Gaines Street District. You also have within that Gaines Street District the All Saints community. Then you've got downtown. You've got Frenchtown. You've got Cascades at the other end of Gaines Street, which is going to be in the future its own development. And it will require its own identity around there. I was in charge of the land transfer negotiations that took place between Florida State University and the city of Tallahassee that gave us those 5 acres that they previously owned, which we now have an RFP on this, a request for proposal on the street for the redevelopment on that site that pays tribute to the historic elements that exist there, but also make way for the future living facilities, right? We've referred to Cascades as our own Central Park. And so what does the housing look like that will grow up around there in addition to and in respect for the traditional neighborhoods that already surround that park? We've got Midtown now. You've got the Market Street District at the northern end of the city. And now up at Bannerman, you've got Bannerman Crossing, which is its own sort of development. So, you know, our community is growing, I think, in really important, important ways that are giving us brand and brand identity in various parts of this community that make it attractive and, if you will, forgive me, sexy for folks to want to live and work and play in these areas. And I think that's good. I think a city our size, a capital city of the third largest state in this country, a city that has, you know, is the most educated in the state of Florida with roughly one of every two persons having at least a bachelor's degree, a city that's trying to put an emphasis on growing its entrepreneurial sector, growing its advanced manufacturing sector, growing its investment in the healthcare field. We're so well primed to be a breakout community. And I think that we can achieve that without losing fidelity to all the things that make Tallahassee so special, our trees, our topography, the quality of life that people here have really come to enjoy. I think we can grow smart, but we've got to be really intentional about that.
Yeah. I think it's interesting to hear you talk about these developing identities in pockets of our community. And then one thing that I'm hearing, especially in the All Saints District, is concern there about losing that
Absolutely.
Identity that they've developed.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, with there's the hotel coming in that lot and the Publix, and they I think that district feels like a small business, artistic district. Mm-hmm. And they're concerned about how the character of their community could change with some more corporate businesses coming in.
Yeah.
How do we sort of balance that need? You know, I know we need a grocery store there because it's a food desert.
That's
we
right.
need a grocery store
That's
there.
Right.
But at the same time, I assume you want to honor the identity and the character that neighborhood feels it has.
Absolutely.
So how do you balance
yeah,
that?
Yeah, so this is what I mean by being very intentional about the growth that we allow and the rules and regulations within these areas. So the good thing about All Saints is it's separated by a major thoroughfare. And I think it's wholly appropriate for the one side of the street where All Saints exists to keep that bohemian feel, right? That you can live above the, you know, above the shop, if you will. They've got their own degree of commerce coexisting with residential. And I think that that's a good thing. On the other side, which tends to cater a little bit more to the university, if you will, with the exception, if you will, of our own arts district that has grown up there, I think it's appropriate that you have a hotel and residential and retail at ground floor. And the Marriott was the first thing that went in, if you will. In fact, they were there, but when the road hadn't been reconstructed, right? And before anything else came in there, that was important for the grounding of that part of Gaines Street. At the furthermost end of Gaines Street, where Cascades Park is, will be its own will have its own identity. And you'll see a different vibe growing up around there that might be different than what you see in All Saints, which will be different than what you see on the other side of Gaines Street that tends to be more student and campus oriented. And then you've got FAMU Way that's being redeveloped. That's right, you know, just up the block from there, where I think we will have the opportunity to preserve historic neighborhood in that area, while also making way for the ability for redevelopment in the appropriate places along that corridor. We'll have to pay very, very close attention to the kinds of regulation and protections that cover that district. I've said it rather repeatedly as we've had pressure and folks have come on to talk at the City Commission about these kinds of issues, that we don't want to lose the things that have made that area so special. Our planners understand that. It wouldn't be as successful a district were we not to preserve those elements that make it so special. And so it's my hope that we'll continue to do that. But there's no doubt about it. The community will have to pay attention as that area continues to grow, as there will be economic and market pressure as that area becomes more populated and more successful. And so the commission, you'll have to get commitments from those elected officials who will be there at that time that will have to battle with those kinds of decisions. But I do think it's a healthy tension. I think it's a good problem to have, quite frankly. And I certainly think it's a problem that is not beyond our being able to solve it and address it in a way that's true and authentic to the values of this community.
Mm-hmm. I know the City Commission really focused this year on having more citizen input and participation, especially in the budgeting process.
Yes.
And you guys created a web portal where people could really play with the dollar amounts, understand the funds. And I'm wondering if maybe that effort will extend to development in Tallahassee. I think that the comprehensive plan is dense. I mean, it's a dense thing. You guys work through it every year, but I think for the average community member, really understanding what that is, understanding when you guys maybe make a change through ordinance to change some zoning or change things in the plan, I think that might be difficult for the average community member. And it sounds to me like you're saying that in order to grow the community we want, we need that community buy-in.
Absolutely.
So is there a plan for that?
Yeah, so I mean, it's an interesting question, and I've got to put more thought to it. The comprehensive plan, as you may remember, I mean, we would have three cycles of the comp plan going at the same time in 1 year. Our commission made the decision that we were not going to have that. We would have a cycle, because the truth is so much can get lost in that. You've got so much change happening. The community doesn't know what to pay attention to because the change is coming so rapidly. So we reduced that down to one cycle. And it gives the community an opportunity, I think, to engage in that process. And I will tell you, there is no absence of engagement by citizens on that. There are some people in this community, and they are really jewels because of the way in which they pay so close attention. I'm thinking of Dr. Pam Hall as I make this comment, former county commissioner and commission chair, Cliff Thayil, his wife Georgine. There are others who pay really close attention to the elements that are included in that comprehensive plan process. And obviously, there's a notification process that goes along with that. With some of the discussions over these districts, the placemaking, we've actually invited charrette making and charrette feedback from citizens, as well as our institutions of higher education, which are a huge asset to our city, to help guide us, give us input in that process. Because the one thing that we cannot become is anywhere America. We don't want Tallahassee to, frankly, lose its identity out of our thrust for growth and development, that everything new and everything shiny is better than what preexisted it. I don't think that's true. I don't subscribe to that belief. And I think that people really will, as you see the way in which our community has developed, have an appreciation for the fact that we tried to stay true to that, that we tried to, while growing to the best of our ability, also have fidelity to what has existed. And, to your question, I'm open for suggestions around other ways in which the community can continue to be involved in that growth and planning process.
Mm-hmm. What about another concern I hear from people, and we've got just a couple minutes to wrap this one up here, is about rent in some of those new developments we're seeing. How can small businesses afford to rent there and to be in these new big places along Gaines?
Yeah. My guess is that the truth is that the market really does have sort of drive that for a lot of these new developments coming in. But I also think that a number of these redevelopments are having to reconfigure some of these rent and lease rates. We've got folks who came in to develop and set their rent rates extremely high, and many of those places are vacant because folks, it's sort of like water. It'll go where the hole is. And until these folks recognize that just because it's a new thing that you may build and you want to come in and charge exorbitant lease rates for this place, it doesn't mean the community is going to respond by going in there. And I'm thinking specifically of a development that in many ways has remained not as successful as it could be because of that issue. So the market will drive a number of these things. And in some areas, we'll have to take really intentional effort to try to control some of it.
All right. We'll take a quick break here and be right back. Welcome back to Perspectives. Today we're talking with Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum in our studio here. If you'd like to join our conversation, please do so by giving us a call at 414-1234. You can send us an email at perspectives@wfsu.org or find us on Twitter at WFSUPerspective. Mayor Gillum, something that I'd like to talk to you about is the crime rate in Tallahassee. I know that I guess in the most recent crime rates results we received, Tallahassee had among the highest per capita rate for violent crime. Mm-hmm. I know that's something that you and the city commission have been very focused on addressing. Tell me where we stand with that.
Yeah. So this has been an issue that we've put a lot of resources and attention into over the last year and a half, certainly as I've been mayor. We did get some interim news in the 2016 numbers that we're just over a 16% decrease over our 2015 numbers at the same point. So I think we are moving in the right direction. We have Much of the budget increase that took place in last year's budget, not the one that we just approved, there was a decrease in that one, was largely due to the fact that we had approved TPD's request to hire 33 new officers. And the uniqueness around these officers is that they were intended to do community policing work and build and enable new community policing squads. So I do think that we're taking some of the right steps to get that under control. But the truth is, I have tried to also approach the crime issue in multiple layers. That yes, there is the violent crime that we know that there are bad people intention to do bad things, and you've got to do your very best to bring that to heel and deal with that in the traditional crime fighting ways. But there are also these opportunity gaps where you have young people who are either being pushed out by the public education system and therefore aren't going to school and diminish their opportunities at landing a good job and earning good wage, who we really have to intercept at an earlier point, turn them on to the kind of skills and job training opportunities that then put them on a pathway for employment and creating greater opportunities for themselves. I mean, it amazes me how many people and how much, frankly, we take for granted that everybody grows up in an empowering household where your family members encourage you to go out and do great things. That isn't the reality for a lot of kids. And so how does society, where in our infrastructure do we create the opportunity to capture and interfere with that? And so I've created a summer jobs program intentioned around going after young people who are highly susceptible. We used to refer to them as high risk. The White House and the president has referred to these folks as high opportunity, opportunity youth. And so last year, in my first year, we created 100 positions, summer job positions. This year, with the public and private sector combined, created 200 positions where over the summer, these young people worked. They earned a little bit of money for themselves. But better than earning the money, I think, is that they got exposed to what the future could be like if they get themselves on the right path, if they pay attention, they go to school, they graduate, go on to college or get an AA, or they go on, graduate from high school and get trained in a particular skills area, particularly in our blue-collar area where we are not seeing the kind of plumbers and woodwork folks and electricians, automotive technicians that we need. And so we've got to train that group of folks. And so there are many ways in which we've tried to come at this to include increasing our support in the human services space with intentionality toward going into those areas that are most crime-ridden, that have bad health statistics trending in the wrong direction, that have low graduation rates relative to other parts of our city, and attempting to create a change moment through the programs that we funded there that give folks, again, a different outlook and access to better opportunities for themselves and for their families. And the last thing I'll mention on this is the work that we've been doing at the Palmer Monroe Teen Center, where we have introduced, you know, again, civil citation work there. Having judges make references to young people instead of adjudicating them before a court of law, referring them to our community connections program where they're being taught nonviolent communication, where we've had a huge success rate when compared to the recidivism rate of the normal kids who are adjudicated through our system. You know, we're reporting near a 90% success rate with the kids that go through that program who then go on to become productive, and many of them have returned to be mentors for the next class and cohort of young people that come through that program. So we've got to address this at really all ends of the spectrum, that I would be a failure. We would be a failure if we just said hire more officers to arrest more people. That isn't the approach. That isn't the complete approach in and of itself. There are also what I would like to talk about and discuss as an opportunity approach, and that includes some of the things that I just mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the Palmer Monroe Teen Center. I know that during the budgeting process, there was a little bit of concern there where the county was not able to provide the same amount of funding that it had provided in the previous year. I think the city picked that up. But I heard from commissioners that that was not long-term solution. Mm-hmm. You know, you guys said this is important. Yeah. We want to fund this. I guess my question to you is, if this is such an important thing to your community, and you're saying this is very important for reducing crime and for helping our families who live here, what's our plan? Yeah. How do we help
them? Well, I don't know where everyone stands on this, but I'll tell you where I stand on this, which is, if we can quantify the money saved to the system, this has to be part of our crime fighting approach. This has to be part of the solution to bringing our crime rate to heel. And the truth is, and I was saddened by the absence of the county participation this year, I think they should come back into this as a funding partner, because the truth is, the city of Tallahassee doesn't run any jails. So every young person that we divert from the jail system is not an additive to our budget. It's an additive to their budget. And roughly 16,000 to 30,000 is what it costs in this state to incarcerate a youth. Whereas this program in total required 150,000 on behalf of the county to be a partner in it. My hope is that they will take another look at this in the upcoming budget cycle and see, every youth that we divert, for every one of them that we divert, for every one of these folks that we prevent from recidivating, what does that save the system? And if we did it even on a contract basis, right, for every young person that is diverted away from that system, you agree to pay Palmer Monroe Center that amount of money saved in order to save 5-6 more lives. I mean, because that's what it pretty much equates to. For every expense that you make for every one of those lives, you may be saving 10 more on the other end. And I think that's how we have to look at this, is in an investments approach. And with an investment is that it's supposed to pay off. And we are seeing it pay off through the work that happens at Palmer Monroe. And it requires the full participation of both the city and the county. Because when businesses are looking at Tallahassee to relocate and they look at the crime rate, they don't say for the city limits. They say Leon County. When folks are looking at neighborhoods that they want to live in to locate in this community and they see a crime rate, it's not just the city of Tallahassee. They're looking at Leon County. And so we are all in this together, the sheriff's office, the public defender, the state's attorney's office, the school board and the superintendent, the county commission and its chair, the city commission and its mayor. We all have to be at the table and helping to bring about a solution here. And I'm hopeful that's what will happen going forward.
Mm-hmm. Another thing you mentioned in our discussion about community safety here was community policing. Yeah. And I think that's a term that maybe a lot of people don't really understand. I think we picture sort of officer friendly driving through or walking through your neighborhood, you know, saying, hey, you know, Billy, how are you today? That's not really what we're doing in Tallahassee. Yeah. Tell me, what are we doing?
Yeah. So we are in some ways doing that. But, policing has changed and is more sophisticated a bit in its approach. But I'll tell you, one of our chief goals here, when we learned that roughly our officers were spending roughly 90% of their time responding to calls for services. This was prior to the budget increase that we did last year, the tax increase that we did last year.
So that means, just to explain that, that means that they're going out on the call.
Absolutely.
Doing reports. Talking to the person, coming back to the office, writing out paperwork, instead of just sort of driving through neighborhoods
Absolutely.
And seeing what's up.
So community policing departments, on average, their officers spend about 50% of their time responding to calls. The other 50% of their time, they spend circulating in the neighborhood, getting out, talking to neighbors, building relationships and building trust, talking to youth and playing with youth in the neighborhood, so that those young people realize that the first time that they see an officer isn't always a bad thing, and that you can trust these folks and that these folks have your better interests at heart. And that relationship is critical to the work that policing. If people in neighborhoods don't communicate what they see and what they know is going on and who's doing the bad things and who's doing the good things, it makes the officers' work that much more difficult when they're trying to solve crimes and get violent folks out of our neighborhoods and communities until they can be rehabilitated and returned to our communities. That relationship is vital to us being successful at bringing our crime rate to heel. So our need to bring down the amount of time that officers are spent responding to calls for service and allowing them to have better management over their ability to flow and be designated in a particular area of our city. I remember as a young person, my grandmother and my grandfather on the porch calling the law enforcement officer by name. They knew the person by name. He'd come over and my grandmother would give him a glass of tea, right? And I'd play in the yard and kick around a ball with our local police officer. And I think many of us remember days where that relationship looked a lot different than it does today. I don't mean to be Pollyannish about the way this thing should look, because the truth is that there are dangerous people who are intentioned around doing bad things. But overwhelmingly, you've got folks who are in communities that may be struggling in their own kind of way. Yes, they may make mistakes and in some cases may be intentioned around doing bad things. And that has to be dealt with in the proper order and in its proper way. But we've got a number of folks in our community who deserve, frankly, the respect and the interaction and the engagement in their communities to know that law enforcement is there to serve and to protect. And all of our communities are deserving of protection. And they're also deserving of being treated as human and being served. And that's the balance that we're trying to restore, one between the hard edge of law enforcement policing and then the smart approach some people refer to as a soft approach, but I believe it is the smart approach to policing, which is one that returns to the era of community policing, where trust and relationships are built and sustained, and that community works hand in hand with law enforcement to keep those neighborhoods and communities safe.
Mm-hmm. You told that story about yourself as a young boy, you know, where your grandmother recognized the law enforcement officer who was in your neighborhood. And I think that is what a lot of people think of when they think about community policing. But I think that they think that happens because we're selecting police officers from their community. Mm. And I'm wondering if that's something that we're trying to do here.
Yeah,
in Tallahassee.
Absolutely. So I want to give credit to Chief DeLeo, who recognized our need to make sure that we have a diverse policing force as well, and that there are some things we may need to do differently to recruit those individuals into our community and to keep them here. So previously, there was a requirement, obviously, that you had a bachelor's degree to work in our agency. And, you know, we take pride in that, obviously, and I think it has produced really good results. But there are also a myriad of ways that I think folks can come into law enforcement where their previous training should come into consideration. For instance, if you've worked in other law enforcement agencies for a period of time, that ought to recommend you for the position. We now have created the condition for military service to count as qualified experience into our agency. We've also looked at and have included scholarshiping folks from diverse backgrounds to go through our police academy. In fact, I just went to a graduation of a set of new officers that went through the Pat Thomas training program that was specifically designed for law enforcement officers to come back into the TPD department, whereas typically they run that program. We go out and try and recruit and solicit those folks to come to our agency. Well, we handpick these folks first, then scholarshiped many of them through that academy. And their commitment now is to come back into work for the Tallahassee Police Department. And that has allowed us to help ensure the kind of recruits and the kind of individuals that we want to bring into our agency. And those are the kinds of intentional changes that are being made at the police department to ensure that we do have law enforcement that is more reflective of the communities that they're assigned to police.
Mm-hmm. Let's switch topics a little bit here. I want to talk about Hermine.
Yes.
So when I drive around the city, I see that it looks like we're still cleaning up. We're still recovering. Update me a little bit about where we are in that
process.
Yeah.
So, you know, our community, obviously, in the spirit of Hermine, want to also acknowledge Hurricane Matthew and those communities that are still suffering, both domestic and abroad, by the wrath of that storm. And we here in Tallahassee have just had our own recent experience. We had when Hermine came through, 80% of our electric utility system damaged, over 1,000 major trees come down, almost every major traffic signal in our city out, 113 of our pumping stations went down. We had a pretty a devastating effect on our community. And I don't know if you've seen images that have been pushed out by our COT utilities folks that have showed the sheer tonnage of tree debris that has been picked up and has been taken to our waste stations. I mean, it's mountain size levels of debris. And when you've not had a storm in your city in 30 years of this size, your trees hadn't had a good shaking in that period of time, you can imagine the accumulated volume of tree and debris that will come down. We gave ourselves pretty much 4 or 5 weeks for the debris pickup. As you know, we did get the designation from the federal government, and I'm glad we received that designation, because we got it not only at the governmental level, but we also got it at the individual level and at the small business level. So expenses that were incurred that were storm-related, those individuals can apply to FEMA for relief. For those hurricane-related expenses and setbacks. I went and visited businesses that were impacted, that were closed down for 3 or 4 days while their power was out. For small businesses, that can be devastating and unrecoverable for some. And so that assistance, I can't overstate enough what that means for a number of our local and small businesses in this community. So the recovery process still continues. Debris still – we've done a first pass through every area of our city and Leon County at this point, but you've got folks who are still bringing debris out. And we've agreed that we'll continue to pick that debris up for the coming couple of weeks. There are folks who, because they know we're picking up debris and they would have normally had to pay the load and tonnage to be put out, have gone on and taken down trees that they've thought or are perceived to be vulnerable. And we've allowed them to bring that debris to the side of the road, and our folks have agreed to pick that up. So you're still going to see phased debris brought to the side of the road, and that process is going to continue for another several weeks.
All right. Well, Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum, thanks so much for joining us
today.
Thank
you again for having me.
It's been a pleasure having you. Perspectives is produced by WFSU-FM in Tallahassee. Technical assistance is provided by Taylor Cox. Lydell Rawls handles the phones, and I'm Regan McCarthy. Please join us for our next Perspectives right here on WFSU-FM.
Copies of Perspectives are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. Log on to WFSU.org for online archives and podcast. Perspectives is a production of 88.9 WFSU-FM, Tallahassee.